Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
I don't know what will happen tomorrow and what will happen after.
Fear and desperation. Afghanistan wakes up to a terrifying new Taliban reality. A special hour of news and analysis. I'll speak to the Taliban's main spokesman then.
Our friends are going to get killed. They're going to kill us. Our women are not going to have any more rights.
The fate and freedom of women and girls hang in the balance. Peace negotiator and former MP Fawzia Kofi on the grave danger they face. And
we had invested over four administrations, billions of dollars, along with the international community, in the Afghan security and defense forces.
America's 20-year war effort collapses with a whimper. I asked the former Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel what the USA got so wrong. Plus, what this says about the Global Democracy Project with British MP and war veteran Tom Tugendhat. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. As the international community tries to deal with the total takeover of Afghanistan by the Taliban. Over the next hour, we will have news and analysis on the terrifying situation unfolding there. A foreign policy gamble by the United States administration that ended a two-decade, multi-billion-dollar anti-terror effort since 9/11, which has now collapsed at lightning speed. Under withering criticism for spectacularly miscalculating and having no contingency plan in place against the fall of Afghanistan, President Joe Biden addressed the American people and the world.
The truth is, this did unfold more quickly than we had anticipated. So what's happened? Afghanistan political leaders gave up and fled the country. The Afghan military collapsed. Sometime without trying to fight. If anything, the developments of the past week reinforced that ending U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan now was the right decision. American troops cannot and should not be fighting in a war and dying in a war that Afghan forces are not willing to fight for themselves.
But fear is spreading in Kabul as the Taliban install themselves in the presidential palace. With thousands desperate to flee for their lives, Kabul's airport is in a state of chaos. And these are pictures of desperate Afghans attempting to clamber onto a U.S. military plane as it leaves the capital. At least three Afghans were run over and killed. The pictures of the Taliban ensconced and posing in the presidential palace tell the whole story of who is in power right now. Earlier, I asked the Taliban spokesman Suhail Shaheen in Doha about the prospect of an inclusive new Afghan government, as they promise. Suhail Shaheen, welcome to the program. Can I start by asking you exactly what conversations are underway between the new Taliban leadership in Kabul and other Afghan constituencies? Is there any talk or progress towards some kind of new government?
Yes, our program is to form an Afghan inclusive Islamic government. So I expect there will be, in future, in a few days, deliberation for that.
Do you know who you're having those inclusive talks with? We understand former President Hamid Karzai might be involved, former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah. Are these the kinds of people who you are talking to?
I think there will be some well-known figures, but right now I can't say by name, but there will be some well-known figures, yes.
The Taliban and your leaders have said the war is over, we have won, and the occupation and forces have gone, and we now have our independence. Many believe that the Taliban simply wants to take total control and total power. Why should anybody believe that under the circumstances you're interested in other members of the Afghan nation being involved in the future?
Because we think it is important for a durable peace in Afghanistan. And because it is at the basis of our policy that we do not want a monopoly of power. And when we can have a comprehensive, durable peace, when all Afghans have participation in a future government, that's why we call it an Afghan inclusive Islamic government. So for that reason, we want to have this government, Afghan inclusive government.
So as you know, Sohail Shaheen, for the last several, I would say, months, certainly the Doha negotiations, the last several weeks and days, as you have conducted this lightning and very well strategized takeover of the country, most in the international community are saying, well, we can't really trust what the Taliban says. Let us look at what they are doing. So you say no revenge, amnesty for even the other side, even the soldiers from the Afghan government side. And yet you can see the scenes of chaos at the Kabul airport where terrified Afghans are escaping you. They're trying to escape you right now, clinging to aircraft, falling from wings of planes, just scrambling to get out. They are terrified. They must have a reason to be terrified. What can you say to these people?
I think they do not have reasons. While we have issued a statement after a statement, why have we issued remarks after remarks by the spokesmen? So why they are terrified? So we are assuring them that there will be no risk to their property, to their lives, to their honor. So I'm also surprised why they are terrified in fleeing the country, why the country need them. This is our country, a country of all Afghans. This country needs reconstruction. So that as Afghan, they should come together and rebuild this country to have a peaceful coexistence and tolerance among each other.
So obviously, Sohail Shaheen, many remember what happened when you were in charge in the late 90s, before 9/11, and there was a lot of revenge and a lot of retribution. But let's talk about just the last few weeks and months. As you know, we have discovered a video that's been all over the air from July with Taliban fighters executing 22 Afghan commandos who were trying to surrender. That is a terrifying thing. That is what people are looking at and hoping doesn't happen to them today. Human Rights Watch, the international organization that monitors events in Kandahar, say that now the Taliban have been detaining and executing suspected members of the provincial government and security forces, and in some cases, their relatives. There have been assassinations on the government side as you have moved forward and now into Kabul. So these are legitimate things that have happened. Why are you saying that this is not going to happen when we're getting reports that it is happening?
About that video which was referred to, it is a fake video. I have already refuted that and all our spokesmen. And about if there is any case and they bring it, we will investigate that. On the basis of our policy, they are given amnesty, and there is no harm to anyone. If anyone claims they have been any threat to their lives or any case of assassination or any case, we are committed to investigate that and to bring the culprit to the court and to see his or her punishment.
I know you say that's fake video and maybe you want to disassociate yourself from it at this point. But certainly CNN and others verified that video. But let's move on.
Yes, because I investigated that video. That's why I'm saying it is a fake.
Your statement recently says, or the Taliban statement, all those who previously worked and helped the invaders or who are now standing in the ranks of the corrupt administration of Kabul, the Islamic Emirate, that's you, has opened its door for them to and has announced amnesty. So now let's talk about those members of the ordinary Afghan people who have helped US forces in the past, who have worked as translators, who have helped the current, or rather the fallen government, who have helped NGOs, who've been on the forefront of women's rights and activism. They are also terrified and they're desperate to be airlifted out of Afghanistan. What will you say and guarantee for those people who are Afghans, who have worked with international forces in the past?
They should not be terrified or desperate. Our guarantee is our official statements, ensuring that there will be no danger to their property, honor, and life. That is our commitment and also guarantee, because this is something official which reflects our position. So, and they can see right now in the districts that are under our administration. So all the people, they lead their normal life. The schools are open, the offices are open, and the businessmen do their trade and business. So this is a practical example. So why they are terrified? They should not be terrified.
Well, they report, and we're hearing interviews from, let's say, inside Kabul, that the Taliban are setting up checkpoints in various neighborhoods, that they are very afraid of house-to-house searches, that many have gone to try to hide, particularly those who are more prominent and who may be known for having helped international forces, etc. And they're very concerned, as one said, that should the Taliban come to their house and recognize them, quote-unquote, they will get their head cut off. This is a very real fear, and it's not based on nothing. It's based on what happened the last time you were in power. So have you changed that much? And again, apart from your words, why should people believe you?
About the checkpoints, they are that to prevent any insecurity, that the thieves, the burglars, and the kidnappers do not carry out what they want to do. That is for this. This is these checkpoints are for the security of the people. These checkpoints have not been set up to harass people. So, because there was a welcome before that, you know, we issued the statement that our forces are instructed to remain at the gates of Kabul city and not to enter the city. But when the Kabul administration forces, they left their position and their police station and everything, and there was a vacuum. The burglars, the thieves, they came, they were looting people's properties, houses. That is why we were forced to enter the Kabul city. Now we have set up the checkpoints in order to prevent anarchy, a chaotic situation, and to maintain the security of the city. So they should not be worried. Rather, they should be happy with that.
Well, certainly women are not happy. And I asked you, had you changed? And I just want to, you know, ask you to react to some of these. Some are talking about burning their certificates of education, some of these women. And we've already heard from our own correspondents on the ground that, you know, the Taliban asked one of our female correspondents to move aside because she was a woman. And that, you know, they shouldn't, women should not be, you know, interacting with anybody, any male outside their family. That young girls, you say they'll be allowed to go to school, but we understand only up to a certain age and only to study religion. For women, it's a very, very terrifying day to see the Taliban, you all, take over. And I'm wondering what you can guarantee for women so that they can keep the rights that they've gained up until now.
You know, the media outlets in Kabul, they are operative. They carry out their broadcasting activities. There are many journalists right now based in Kabul, even foreign journalists. They carry out their work and filing reports from there. So, and also the schools will be open, and the girls and women, they will be going to schools and as teachers, as students. So you will see it in a few days. That is my expectation, in a few days.
Well, we certainly will obviously be watching very closely. But I want to ask you one final question. The former president of Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani, fled the country. He seemed to indicate that it was either a choice between being executed on the spot or fleeing. What would have happened to Ashraf Ghani if he had stayed as your forces, your new leadership, entered the presidential palace in Kabul?
Right now, Karzai is there in Kabul. Abdullah is there. Nothing has happened to them. Even their security is maintained. If he surrendered to the people, to the will of the people of Afghanistan, and he avoided the bloodshed, it would have been better for him. So, when it would have been if he was fighting, and during fighting, he was harmed. That is another story. But if he had surrendered and handed over the power peacefully, so of course he will not be harmed. His life would have been safe.
On that note, Sohail Shaheen, Taliban spokesman, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
And now, before we turn to my next guest, who's a female Afghan lawmaker, let us just pause for a minute to remember how utterly brutal life was for Afghan women when the Taliban were last in charge in those years before 9/11.
For centuries, Afghan women have been ruled by the disciples of Islam and tribal tradition. But when the Taliban were in power, they subjected women to a brand of barbarity more cruel and oppressive than we had witnessed anywhere else in the world. The Taliban's vice squad would beat them for showing their faces, their ankles, or even if a strand of hair peeked through their burqa, the suffocating cloak that all women were forced to wear.
So you heard me ask Sohail Shaheen, the spokesman, about the plight of women in Afghanistan today. He claims that they will keep their rights, but the reality is that many are terrified that history will repeat itself. Fawzia Kofi is a former lawmaker, and she's also a member of the now fallen Afghan government's negotiating team in those peace talks with the Taliban. And she's joining me now from Afghanistan. Fawzia Kofi, welcome back to our program. We have spoken to you over many, many months and years. And I'm wondering how you are dealing with the reality of your situation right now.
Thank you, Christian. This morning when I woke up and I saw everything is reversed to 22 years back, I couldn't believe that the whole 20 years was like a dream for many people in Afghanistan to see where we went back. It is shocking for many people how quickly and rapidly everything collapsed and how military operations were undertaken to take over the power while we were negotiating. And if only negotiations were preferred and expedited, I'm sure people would have celebrated today the stability and peace. But unfortunately, many people are uncertain about what will happen next, especially the younger generation and the women of Afghanistan, who are the product of the past 20 years.
Fawzia, so many Afghans have been born in the last 20 years. It's a very, very young nation. Many do not remember or have any experience with Taliban rule, and many have put their fate in a better future. Certainly women and girls have had a better future and a better opportunity. What are you hearing, if anything, from your female friends, from parents with young girls? Are people hiding out? Are they waiting to see? Do they fear the worst? Do they believe what the Taliban is saying publicly, that they will have their rights guaranteed? What are you hearing?
Well, the situation is very chaotic, Christian. In a lawless society where there is a vacuum of power, people have a right to be terrified and to be uncertain about their future. In my lifetime, I have seen many regimes change through military coup or military takeover. But certainly not my daughters and not the younger generation of Afghanistan. They have grown up with the world technology and a different life. Certainly the life that I have not had when I was a child. So for them to see everything went back to scratch and they see the flag change very quickly in the presidential palace, is shocking. Yes, they were not many people, especially the young girls and boys who went to school in the past 20 years. They went to university. They are financially self-sufficient, most of them. They don't remember, the Taliban or the civil war, but they have heard it through their parents. They have read it in the history. And I think now they see it in some provinces. Unfortunately, in some places today, like for instance in Kabul, was just a military. You could only see rangers going from one location to the other, or in the other provinces, you could only see rangers going on military cars. We have also reports of women's rights violation and oppression from some provinces. Women cannot go out without male companion to work or to even get their basic supplies. So these are not new to in terms of the history for many people in Afghanistan. But after 20 years of blood and treasure, we were hoping that things will be different. I have said it in your program last time, and I must also say that it is a failure of morale for many of us, including for our United States friends. I think if the U.S. would have not rushed their withdrawal, we would have the chance to reach a political settlement in a way that everybody could be part of a power-sharing government. Yes, people of Afghanistan were not happy with the previous president and the way he flee Afghanistan, of course, raises a lot of questions. Most of us are in Afghanistan. We have been with our people under extremely difficult times. We will continue to struggle for our desired country. So people were not happy with the previous situation as well, but they did not want to go from bad to worse. They deserve a better life.
So, you know, there are a couple of questions I want to ask you. Obviously, those people who are trying to flee, many of them seem to be people who worked for either the U.S. or other internationals. Women's rights activists, we understand, are at the airport. Many, many Afghans who feel that what they did over the last 20 years in the pursuit of peace and freedom and human rights are going to make them targets for the Taliban. Do you believe what Suhail Shaheen told me, and you were listening to the interview, that there will be amnesties, that Afghanistan needs all its people, that the country needs to be reconstructed, that they don't want people to flee and that they guarantee them safety and security? Do you believe that?
What is sad is, Christian, you see all the educated, talented Afghans who want to leave their country. That is... For each individual, the country has invested thousands of dollars to be who they are now. Their families, the society, the government invested on them. To see them being so disappointed, daily basis, I until now receive so many text messages, telephone calls, contact from people across Afghanistan. And trust me, even if I don't, for whatever reason, reply to their, express sympathy with them, The next question is, are you not in Afghanistan? So the fact that I'm in Afghanistan gave a lot of people a morale, gave them a morale that it will be okay. So I think the Taliban, really, the political office, I have been talking with them. They need to make themselves relevant. They have been speaking, and their generic press releases have been nice, indicate that they have shifted their policies. But that is not enough. Their foot soldiers are doing differently. So I think the political office really, and this is something I have delivered the message to some of those people that I have been engaged in negotiation over the past 2-3 days, that you have to really take bold steps to gain the trust of people. This country cannot be built with a group of people, with guns. We need the professionals. This country needs the talents. And above all, only an inclusive government can bring peace and stability. Stability and not fighting is not peace. It is not peace. People have to feel peaceful. People need to trust their government. And yes, there is a military takeover, but we need to give the people the voice they require, the share they deserve in their government.
Fauzia, you are in an undisclosed location in Afghanistan, which we are not going to reveal, obviously, for your own security. It is interesting to hear you say you've been talking to those Taliban who you've obviously met during your role as peace negotiator in Doha and otherwise. Are you afraid for your own safety? Do you fear a knock on the door at any time of day or night?
It's a very uncertain situation for many of us. Some of us who have kind of invested their energy to serve the country and contribute to a free, liberal, better Afghanistan, they are more at risk. I have been sharing my concerns over what I see from time to time to those with whom we have been engaged in the negotiation, and they have been giving me responses that, you know, this is not true, this is not what they think has happened. So, but I think they seriously, seriously need to take bold steps. First of all, to ensure that they will not repeat the things that they have been repeating so far, that their commanders listen to them, that their foot soldiers listen to them, and people should trust them. It is not just press releases that people can trust. They have to really. I have seen today. I talked with some female journalists. Probably you know most of them. They were telling this country is not anymore for us to live. Only 2 months ago, when I talked to these women and I asked them, do you have any plan B? They said, no, this is our country. We will continue to stay forever. Of course, there were poverty, corruption, etc. in the previous government. But the fact that these people had the freedom to express those views, express the fact that they are suffering from corruption, from poverty, I think that's what they value. So I think it's important that the Taliban should take bold steps to give people the liberty they desire and include people in the decision-making.
Fauzia, what would you say to the United States right now? I mean, do you feel abandoned? You clearly understood, I guess, that one day the U.S. would have to leave Afghanistan. What would you say, if you could, to a leader, the president, anybody, if you were to see and talk to them right now after what's happened?
Right now, I'm very, very angry. So probably right now is not the right moment to give my message, but I will give it anyway. We did not expect the United States to be in Afghanistan forever. Nobody wants any nation, foreign nation, to be in their country forever. The people of Afghanistan are very famous for fighting against foreigners throughout our history. If you look at our history, it's full of fighting. And the people are proud for who they are. However, the United States came to Afghanistan not because we invited them, but because they thought that Afghanistan can be a threat, and it was a threat for their own national security. Therefore, they came in Afghanistan to Afghanistan. We stood with them. We walked with them side by side. We promoted the common principles. They decided to leave without even talking to anybody or asking permission. Everything is centric to their interests. My message would be If Afghanistan is not safe, trust me, your own borders will not be safe.
Fawzia Kofi, thank you so much for talking to us under these very precarious conditions from inside Afghanistan. And we will continue to follow you, we'll continue to monitor, we'll continue to watch and to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. So where does the failure for this total collapse of the Afghan forces lie? Chuck Hagel was the Secretary of Defense under President Obama, and he's joining me now from McLean, Virginia. Secretary Hagel, you just heard a very well-known legislator, member of the Afghan peace negotiating team, Fawzia Kofi, express her deep disappointment in what the United States has done. Can you understand that? And can you understand the anger, as she expressed, of the Afghan people today towards your country?
I can. And it's a tragic situation, sad, sad situation, which I don't think anybody wanted to ever see come, but it is here. I think in assigning blame here, we need to go back 20 years. That's how long the United States has been there. A lot of mistakes were made from the time we entered Afghanistan. One of the things that's been consistent, and you talked a little bit about this with your guest, is that each president, four presidents, since we invaded and occupied Afghanistan 20 years ago, have said, we will be leaving, we will be coming out. It's the Afghan people's decisions to make in what kind of country they want. How do they want to run their country? The history of Afghanistan, we didn't understand at all. I mean, Afghanistan has never, ever been governed by a central government. I mean, the British found that out, the Soviets found that out, Alexander the Great found that out. We never understood the culture, we never understood the religion, we never understood the tribalism, all the dynamics that make up a culture. And here we are, 20 years as a Western power into this country and putting a lot of money in it, $2 trillion, corruption. No secret, the Afghan government is one of the most corrupt in the world. So a lot of mistakes were made by us, by the United States, and I think by the Afghans. The people who got caught in the middle, it's always the people in the middle who have no say. That's the unfortunate part of this. You talk about women, girls, rights, education, driving good people, smart people out of their country. That's a consequence, hopefully, that we won't see to the extreme. But I think you've got to survey and look at Christine, the entire last 20 years. One of the big mistakes that we made was we tried to mold an Afghan army in the likes of an American army. Well, that was a mistake. The Afghans' culture, everything about them are different from us. Doesn't mean that they're smarter, not as smart, none of that. But they have to have their own will to do the things that they want to do for their country, and we've got to respect that. I don't think we ever did respect that enough. We tried to do so much, and we did so much. Mm-hmm. We did so much good in 20 years. But unfortunately, it is where it is today, and that's, I suspect, a lack of planning for the worst. In a situation like this, mm-hmm. and fortunately, we haven't been through many of them, but we've been through Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, you plan for the worst. And I support President Biden's decision to leave. A lot of mistakes were made, I think, in the planning for that, not planning well enough. I don't know. I wasn't part of it, so I don't know the details. But it's complicated. It's unfortunate and damn sad.
It's one thing to support your president. Clearly, a nation makes its own national security decisions. Clearly, a forever war couldn't last forever. But as you yourself said, there was no contingency, there was no planning. It appears that the United States, you know, certainly under President Trump, who started these negotiations, kind of gave the shop away without any conditions and without extracting any promises from the Taliban. Listen to the Taliban say one thing at the table while watching them strategize on the ground. So, don't you think that the U.S., and you as Secretary of Defense, should have, I don't know, maintained air superiority, I don't know, kept Bagram to an extent, used the time to keep the ability to use air power, you know, close to Afghanistan instead of far away and other bases? it didn't really have to happen this badly.
Well, you mentioned President Trump and how we started that in February of last year in Doha. We eliminated the Afghan government. President Trump did not have at the table in Doha the Afghan government. We, the United States, cut the deal with the Taliban. Well, right there, that showed very clearly that we were going to cut the Afghan government out, and we were coming out no matter what. And all that came after that, the resulted after that, releasing 5,000 Taliban prisoners and so on, were not in the interest of the Afghan government. And Ghani's government tried to say that. But as you move this forward, and to your question, I don't think another year or another half year would make a lot of difference. And I say that for two reasons. Over the last couple of years, actually last 10 years, but let's just take the last 2 years, every news outlet in the world has charted the progress and the control of the Taliban in Afghanistan, that they've controlled 50-60% of Afghanistan. The progress the Taliban were continuing to make was clear to everybody. I don't know if our intelligence wasn't focusing on that enough, or if we, our government wasn't, I don't know. But that was no surprise as to how things started to really unravel and unfold when this thing got to the point, okay, now we are starting to bring our people out. I'm not so sure, and the other point I'd make is how fast this unraveled. I mean, this was something I suspect no one predicted. Well, that means to me that, Taliban was pretty strong in all these cases.
Well, yeah, but you say correctly that every news organization in the world was witnessing this and reporting this, so people should have known about it, did know about it, and one of the people who didn't know about it, you know, even before he's addressed the American people over this latest, well, the fall of Afghanistan, President Biden essentially told the world that this, what has happened, was not inevitable. Here is what he said.
You have the Afghan troops have 300,000 well-equipped, as well-equipped as any army in the world, and an air force, against something like 75,000 Taliban. It is not inevitable. There's going to be no circumstance where you see people being lifted off the roof of a embassy in the, of the United States from Afghanistan. It is not at all comfortable.
Whoops. Well, in fact, it did happen with lightning speed, and now everybody's got egg on their face at the very least. So my question to you is, because you were Defense Secretary under President Obama, he had to decide, and he did, to follow the U.S. military advice and to keep adding and maintaining American military presence there. Can you explain to the American people, you did a little bit, but where those trillions or billions of dollars went in terms of, and why... Or did you mistakenly believe the Afghan government side when many, many people were telling you about the corruption in the Afghan government side and the fact that they weren't even paying their frontline forces, that they sent them to the front lines, often without food or water that we're hearing now, much less arms or ammunition? What the heck was going on?
Well, in 2014, when President Obama said, we are going to end America's combat role in Afghanistan, then we pulled out tens of thousands of American troops and closed hundreds of bases in Afghanistan. And President Obama said at that time, this is the beginning of us, the United States, coming out at some point, and we'll do that in a procedural and coordinated way with the Afghan government. But that, this was 2014, so that's 7 years ago that we knew that we were coming out. As to the other questions about money and so on, I don't know. I mean, I left the Defense Department in 2015. What happened after that, I didn't stay involved. I mean, I read things, but I was not privy to intelligence reports. But my bigger point here is, and as I said at the earlier part of this interview, every president has said, we are going to come out, that we were gearing everything that we were doing with the Afghan government, with the Afghan army, with the support of of the United States for the Afghan government and the forces, Afghan forces, to get ready for the time when we are coming out. We obviously made mistakes in that process. We obviously underestimated everything in that process. The president's comments, I don't know what led him to make those comments or to be reassured enough to make those comments. But
okay,
it is what it is.
So let me ask you finally, well, it is what it is an unfortunate statement, because it's not just mistakes. It is the handover of what was a terrorist haven back to those who kept it as a terrorist haven. So what message did this send to the rest of the world about America's commitment in anti-terror or the spread of democracy and freedom and human rights? And particularly, do you believe, you may not be a current Secretary of Defense and you left a long time ago, but you've also been a senator, you are very well informed. Do you believe that this is going to put at risk again Afghanistan as a potential terrorist safe haven that could come back to attack the United States in some form or fashion or its allies around the world?
Well, it could. Yes, absolutely. There are going to be consequences for this. No matter what. There are going to be political consequences, there will be security consequences, and diplomatic consequences, and you just noted that. How other nations respond to this, I don't know. But I think other nations who have been involved with us in Afghanistan understand the realities of what was going on, and because they were there and they saw it. I hope it doesn't cost this country a lot of diplomatic trust and confidence. It might, it could. This is going to be with us for a while. We're not going to get out of this just after this episode, but we're going to be dealing with this for a few years down the road. And the other thing I would say, though, this is 2021, not 2001. The threats, the capabilities, the capacities of the United States or our allies, all of that has changed. That doesn't mean that Afghanistan could get back where it was when we found it in 2001, a training ground for terrorists. It could very well be that.
Former Secretary Chuck Hagel, thank you for joining us. Now, here in the UK, the government is also scrambling to get its nationals out of Afghanistan and trying to evacuate those Afghans who worked with British forces. Amid those chaotic scenes at Kabul airport, Defense Secretary Ben Wallace, himself a former soldier, has admitted in an emotional interview that, quote, some people will not get back.
We're not doing other diplomatic functions. We are simply there to process all those British passport holders and all those people we have an obligation to. And, you know, our men and women of our armed forces are risking their lives in doing that, but that is the right thing to do. They've risked their lives the last 20 years. And, you know, at the very least, our obligation has to be as many of these people through the pipeline as possible. But I think I also said, and it's a really deep part of regret for me, that some people won't get back. Some people won't get back, and we will have to do our best in third countries to process those people.
His voice cracking there with the severity and the seriousness of the ethical dilemma that the West really poses now with its duty to those Afghans who helped them. And my next guest has described the fall of Kabul as Britain's biggest foreign policy disaster since the 1956 Suez Canal crisis. MP Tom Tugendhat is chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, and he served as a soldier in Afghanistan. He's joining me from Norway right now. Welcome to the program. You saw your very own defense secretary break down there, his voice cracking with the weight of responsibility that clearly he feels towards those who have put their lives at risk in Afghanistan to help you all. Tell me how you feel about that and whether you think that you will manage to get everybody out. He says clearly many will fall between the cracks.
Look, Ben has been working this now for many days and weeks, and I'm sure, sadly, what he says is correct. He knows exactly what he's doing and has been working 24/7 for the last, God knows, many days, many weeks, to try and get a decent resolution. Not a great resolution, but a decent resolution that gets as many people out as possible. I've spent the last week, maybe 2 weeks, responding, trying to get interpreters I worked with in Helmand, in Kandahar, in Kabul, people who served alongside us, the special forces we trained, anybody who I think we owe a duty to. I've been trying to get them into the airport, into the process, and out of the country. But I have to say, I got a heartbreaking voicemail yesterday from a very dear friend who described how he was now waiting in his home as he knew that the Taliban were knocking on doors as they went down the road and looking for him and his comrades. And, well, he hasn't texted anymore. So I don't know what's happened.
Oh, God, Tom Tugendhat, that's just too chilling to even hear you recount. And you heard what the Taliban spokesman said to me, that they will not be conducting revenge raids or going house to house. You've seen the pictures, which are horrific, of Afghans trying to literally clamber aboard a moving U.S. military transport plane on the tarmac there. Do you believe what the Taliban say about giving amnesty and protecting all Afghans, no matter what they did in the last 20 years?
I don't believe them for a second. I can tell you why I don't believe them, because I've seen in the photos that have been sent to me by friends in Lashkargah and Kandahar the reality of the Taliban reoccupation. I've seen the photographs of people we trained, people we served with, people of integrity who did their best for the Afghan people. And their bodies are lying in the gutter. You know, this is the reality of Taliban rule. We shouldn't have any illusion as to what's going on. This is an organization that is still partnered with Al-Qaeda and ISIS. It is still partnered with the East Turkmenistan Islamic movement. Those people, whether they be in Beijing with Wang Yi or in Moscow with Sergei Lavrov, who think that they've made a deal that is going to keep them safe, well, all they're doing is throwing meat at the crocodile in the hope that they'll eat them last.
What do you think the United States and Britain, NATO, but the United States, which led this withdrawal, this retreat, should have done as a contingency plan, given that presumably they weren't going to stay there forever? Or do you think there's a scenario in which, for a relatively inexpensive investment in people and strategy, might have been able to stay and stave this off?
Look, this has been described as a forever war by some people. For some reason, nobody describes the defense of Germany until 1991 as a forever war, or the US military contribution to South Korea as a forever war, or the US military contribution in Japan, or the British military contribution in Cyprus. I mean, I can go on, the basing in the Gulf, the support to counter-piracy operations. None of these are described as forever wars. And they're not, because we recognize that these are essential elements to defending ourselves by extending the perimeter of our security and making sure that allies stand with us when we ask for them. And I'm afraid the short-sightedness that we've made here is to confuse a sunk cost with a future cost. The sunk cost is real. We have spent trillions of dollars in Afghanistan. I can point to the graves of the men I've buried, and I'm sure many other soldiers can do the same. But they're not going to rise again just because we leave. That is a sunk cost, I'm afraid. It's a sunk cost many of us have to live with every day. An enduring cost is different. An enduring cost is something we need to make sure is affordable, that we can cope with it. And in Afghanistan, I think we could have got there. We chose not to, but that's a political choice. And for 2,500 soldiers, what's that? That's half the crew of an aircraft carrier. We've left. And we're seeing what that choice has cost.
It really is a tragic situation. And the way you describe it is very clear. But I just want to ask you, because you mentioned all these other allies, these other deployments, which have been, you know, taken place for a long-term reason. But your allies in Afghanistan appeared to be somewhat unreliable, right? I mean, it seems that the government was corrupt, the government did not really pay or take care of its forces that you all were funding and trying to train and maintain. How much responsibility do your partners in Afghanistan, not the Taliban, but the partners on the government side, how much responsibility do you think they bear?
Of course they bear a responsibility. I'm not going to deny that. Of course they bear a responsibility. But after 40 years of war, it's hardly surprising that it was a corrupt and broken state. That's not really a surprise. In the same way as Germany in 1950 would not have been described as a reliable partner. The political leaders, and there were some very impressive political leaders in Germany in 1950, were not all people that, with hindsight, we would happily have sat down with. Many of them had pasts that, frankly, left a lot to be desired. But the idea that we could have pulled out of Germany in 1950 and expected the Wehrmacht to have stood up to the Soviet troops was ridiculous, and we knew it. Mm-hmm. Because it takes more than 5 years to build a state. And the reality is that we've only just started easing down on the fighting in the last 3 or 4 years. You know, the last British soldier was tragically killed in combat in December 2013, and the last US soldier a few years ago. You know, this is a war that has been winding down. And what we've just done, I'm afraid, is thrown fuel on it.
Thank you so much for putting this into such important and vital perspective, Tom Tugendhat, formerly deployed in Afghanistan. Thank you very much for joining us. And finally tonight then, let us flash back to one of my own reporting trips to Afghanistan. This was 2002, months after the Taliban was overthrown, and I witnessed then the spark of hope and jubilation as girls were finally given the opportunity to go to school, a privilege that many take for granted around the world. But I also discovered that even without the Taliban standing in their way, many would still not receive an education.
Everyone we talk to says only time and education will bring real rights for Afghanistan's women. And nowhere is that more keenly felt than among girls who are now allowed to go to school. Under the Taliban, it was illegal. But teachers like Mrs. Zubeda taught in a flourishing network of underground schools, secret places like this one in the countryside. Mrs. Zubeda set up her school above her husband's office. He's a doctor. Hundreds of girls learned to read and write here. And when the Taliban came to investigate, Mrs. Zubeda blamed the noise on her husband's patients.
Was it difficult? Did you have to be careful in case the Taliban find out?
It was very difficult. I had to be very careful. Sometimes I was changing the time of this lesson. Sometimes I was changing the place.
Why weren't you afraid? They could have done terrible things to you.
I don't know. I was not afraid at all.
But if they'd caught you, they would have whipped you, no, at least.
But I had to help the people.
Were you girls afraid when the Taliban would come round?
Yes. We used to hide our books under our burqas to avoid beatings from the Taliban. But a few girls were caught and roughed up. One day, the Taliban approached me as I was going to school. So I quickly hid my books under a pile of hay. And when they left, I grabbed the books back from the cows.
You really got to want to go to school. But you know what surprises me?
Yes.
That you girls would take so many risks just to learn something, just to read a book.
They love to study. They wanted always education.
What do you want to be when you graduate from this class? Who wants to tell me?
Malim.
Teacher.
A doctor.
Doctor. You want to be a doctor?
They have lots of wishes.
And lots of hopes.
And lots of hopes, yeah.
But as we found, girls who make it to college in the big city are having a hard time. Most of the women at this engineering school in Kabul have dropped out because the dorms were destroyed during the war and they've nowhere to sleep. After the Taliban fled, more than 3 million girls and boys rushed back to school. That's more than double what the government expected. But there are still many girls who may never see the inside of a classroom. The father of these little girls keeps them at home weaving carpets.
Why don't the men let the girls go to school?
Our men are strict, and they don't let the girls go to school.
We put the same question to Mohammed Hussein, the man of the house.
Why don't you let your children go to school, your girls go to school?
They're making $5 a month weaving carpets, and I'm unemployed. If they go to school, we can't even pay for their books.
But look, you've got all girls, and one day they're going to be able to make more money if they're educated. Do you understand that?
But poor people like us don't have that choice. If the girls don't work, we'll all be hungry.
The women in this household want their girls to be educated, but in the end, it's the man who decides.
He is the one who sets the rules.
Yes, it's true.
An important reality check from a wife and a mother that 20 years of a multi-billion-dollar international effort in one of the poorest countries in the world means that many parents will choose still to keep their girls working and not learning. That is it for now. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.